Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, October 19th, The Wire with Wigs edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. And in the New York studios, we have June Thomas, managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So before we get started, I will say last week's segment, we got a lot of response for our Slate Plus segment. I'm sorry for those of you who didn't hear it, about dating men your own age. And I would say that the most common response we got was that I can't date men my own age because they're immature. That came up a lot. I was surprised by that.
I'm not.
Yeah, I guess not. I mean, we discussed that on the segment, but it did seem people were like, not going to do it. So
we also got some interesting responses from gay people who said, wow, that was strange. Didn't know what, like, that was almost like a sociological or anthropological case study that is a culture I don't know much about.
But. One guy was like, June, I admired your patience.
With the straight people. That was great. Anyway, so let's jump into our show. We are going to talk about Harvey Weinstein because how could we not? Tremendous fallout from that situation. Second, The Deuce, the HBO show about 42nd Street, prostitution, early days of porn. And finally, ageism and our cultural prejudice against it. And for a Slate Plus topic, June, do you want to say what we're talking about?
Sure, in our Slate.
All the sexy witches, all the sexy witches out there, pay attention.
Pay attention. Sexy nurses, sexy everything. We will be asking whether Halloween costumes are perforce sexist. Are all Halloween costumes sexist? And if you want to listen to that segment and support Slate's journalism, you can join Slate Plus. Your first year is $35 a year by going to slate.com/xxplus.
Wait, like, so if you're wearing a Nixon mask, we have to argue that that's sexist? Or well, just like the whole industry?
That's the question. Is the Halloween costume industrial complex perforce sexist? Is it? Who knows? We'll discuss that.
All right. I look forward to that. Okay, so our first topic, Harvey Weinstein. I'm sure most of our listeners have tuned into this. Hollywood titan accused now by dozens of women of both sexual harassment and sexual abuse. Women who are really, really famous, less famous, just so many women. Amazing investigative stories, both in the New York Times and the New Yorker. It's been known for years, decades, only it's coming out now. There's things that are particular about this case, and then there's kind of culture-shattering, earth-shaking ramifications that are general and seem to be affecting lots of different industries. So a few days later, we are going to talk about the fallout of the case. All right. So first, the particulars. In many ways, Harvey Weinstein is a case of one, right? Or even that industry is a case of one. Like, I was trying to think to myself, what other industry is exactly like this and creates exactly these situations? So what is unique about this case before we get to what affects all of us?
Well, Harvey Weinstein was an incredibly powerful person in this particular way. He obviously had a lot of power in Hollywood. He could an artistic power too, right? Not just like box office power. He was making movies that people really respected, that the Academy consistently chose.
More than 300 Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
For his movies.
But he also had this symbiotic relationship. I think it's fair to characterize it that way with the press. Miramax was an advertiser a lot of places. Harvey was an important source for a lot of people. He also seems to have given a lot of journalists contracts of various kinds that may or may not have influenced whether this story came out before now. He was someone who wielded power in ways direct and indirect and like was very interested in keeping a stranglehold on that.
And something that got a lot of attention I don't know if I was uncomfortable with it because it was too true or just like it annoyed me because it didn't seem relevant, but much hay was made of the fact that he's a major Democratic donor, that he's given a lot of money to what I think we would see as very good causes. And that caused backlash from, I would say, conservatives who were like, oh, they're not saying anything about Harvey, right in the middle of everybody piling on Harvey.
Yes, you didn't know that the biggest problem with Harvey Weinstein is that Hillary Clinton didn't distance herself from him,
exactly.
The major story here.
Exactly.
I mean, so I keep thinking about this case as, yes, okay, it's a very particular story about a very particular man, but it's also such a metaphor for every other office power dynamic between the sexes, right? Like, Hollywood is the most extreme version of it because it lays it out all on the table. Like, you have power, you have youth and beauty, here is how, you know, I'm going to use you. But like, a version of those dynamics actually exists in other industries too.
Like what? Give me an example. Because I was trying to think like, all right, Hollywood is the place where you have ridiculous emphasis on status, you know, the norms of Hollywood and how people behave and how their kind of whims are, you know, what's the right word? Just indulged is a little bit extreme, right? And then the kind of the interdependence yeah. between men like that and the endless supply of young women. Because I was thinking maybe sports has an element of this, like coaches and young, like gymnasts. I was just trying to think what other worlds kind of mimic this horrific dynamic that you know, creates this potential for abuse.
That's definitely a variety of that same dynamic, but it's different. It's easier to point out the differences because, you know, talent is a factor in both. You know, you have these powerful men who can bring out the talent, who have the power to give opportunities. But the talent, especially in sports, is so, you know, it's so much easier to quantify. You know, yes, you can make, you know, a coach and training and all of that can make a difference, you know, of a few seconds to a time, which is essential. But you still have to run really fast, whereas it seems like everything is subjective in the movie business. You know, the
right.
women are absolutely at the whim. You know, you couldn't say, well, look, she can run really fast, you know. Quantify her acting somehow. It's all, you know, quantify her suitability for that role. It's just absolute. It's very unique, I think.
I don't know. I think Hollywood makes what is subtext elsewhere in the
yes.
culture text,
yes. Yes,
right?
Yes,
like,
yes.
like it is entirely premised on, you know, this relationship between sex and power. And that is obviously beneath the surface in a lot of other,
yeah.
not as explicitly, because if you work in another industry, you're not, you know, the work that you're doing is not necessarily premised on your beauty or your sex appeal. But the reality is, as we've talked about a million Silicon Valley sexual harassment cases this year, coding has nothing to do with, like, you know, how attractive you are. And yet in that industry, it creeps its way into. I don't think it's about the work that's being done. I think it's about the way that men and women are taught on some deep level that they can relate to each other or ought to relate to each other. I just think that it I think that's why people are responding to this so strongly, that it doesn't feel like, you know, just this thing in this crazy industry that I will never have anything to do with. Like, yes, I watch the movies, but I'm not, you know, I'm not a movie star. Who cares? I think people see a magnified version of something they have thought in their daily lives and their interactions of all kinds.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's that the movie business is different and extreme, but because it's so extreme, maybe it's like, look, I don't work in that crazy industry, but I can see it. So, yeah, I agree.
And also, these are the people who are creating our cultural myths.
Right,
right.
Like whether or not this is totally explicit in those, I would argue that oftentimes it is.
Yeah.
Right. Like, they're deciding what stories our culture is telling us about men and women. And so it's more powerful for that reason. You know what I found really moving? This is a little bit of maybe a side issue, but I feel like the more these sexual harassment cases come out, like, Donald Trump, that was so crude, you know, and it didn't have any details to it, really. In this case, you're getting these really moving, like the Asia Argento is one of the actresses who came out in The New Yorker. And there was so much layer. I feel like we're getting more sophisticated in what we can handle as a story of sexual assault and still count it as a story of sexual assault. Now, if it had been just her, I realize it would have been different. Like, this is a power in numbers question. So the fact that she had lots and lots of people other women confirming her story allowed her to tell her story to Ronan Farrow in a kind of, that was the New Yorker story, by the way, in a kind of more layered and detailed, because she did have a relationship with him at some level. She did participate in that relation, and she was absolutely probably raped. Like, all of those things are true, and she felt guilty for years. I mean, it's probably a very, very real account of how sexual assault plays out in a woman's life when it's kept secret. And I thought that was really, I mean, it was novelistic. Like, I thought that would really help people to read that and say, oh, that's exactly what happened to me. Like, those are all the things that I did. That's all the ways I felt about it for years. And everybody's still labeling it sexual assault, you know?
Right. The complicated way that you sort of blame yourself and feel complicit. I give her so much credit for putting that all out there in a way that very easily could be twisted against her. But she was sort of like, no, this is what happened in all of its weird and strange and complicated ways.
Can we talk about him and how he's been portrayed? Because I responded to that a similar way. Like, the whole discussion around, you know, what does he represent to men in the culture? Why are some men holding out and not criticizing him? Like, what is he in the culture? And then also, kind of, is this an illness? You know, is he a broken man? What his brother said about him? Maybe this, because this is all coming out from Hollywood, it's unspooling with so much more kind of narrative richness than usual.
Right. A lot of the discussion of him that I've seen has started from a place of discussing his physicality and almost turning him into the ogre in a fairy tale, right? Yeah. That he's this, in a way that, like, if he hadn't allegedly done so many horrible, horrible things, you'd be like, well, maybe we should stop fat shaming Harvey Weinstein. But in the moment, you're like, yeah, he's a gross man, and people are just searching for ways to discuss it. But a lot of it has centered on, you know, his physical presence in the world and the difference between him and the women he's supposedly assaulted. And there is something to that, right? Like, I'm sure that whatever therapy he is currently supposedly undergoing will center a lot on why he has so many issues around why he's so focused on beauty, right? But that's one way in which it's interesting to me.
There was a great, I think we call them these days, tweet storm by Ben Kling, who I guess works at Tumblr. But he talked about how Harvey Weinstein, quote, exemplifies the conversion of other capitals into sexual capital. And it was a really interesting thread, because even though it was full of kind of, capitalist type buzzwords, I think they're
anti-capitalist.
Anti-capitalist buzzwords. Thank you. Yes. There really is something to this notion that you have to believe, or not you, certain people have to believe in the kind of almost the myth of Harvey Weinstein. You know, Harvey Weinstein has to exist so that people can keep hope alive, even though that hope is completely corrupt and you know, corrupting. Somehow the idea that you just need to get rich. If you're rich and powerful enough, you know, you can have beauty and youth, and that can be yours. And that's it's gross when it's kind of summarized in that way. But I think it is kind of, you know, the hope of Harvey Weinstein powers a lot of, you know, people who have nothing.
Not people, men.
Men, yes, thank you.
Men
yes,
are fed yeah. that cultural script.
Men, and the way we sell that dream, like I thought mm-hmm. about our segment on Hugh Hefner and the just the commodification of women and sex, and it all felt so true in that tweet storm. Like I really could see it. Like you need to believe that if one day you become rich and powerful enough, along with that, like along with your car, your house, comes your woman, you know? And if that is so culturally deep, but that really depressed me, that tweet storm, because I thought, like, is that a cultural script or is that something deeper than a culture? Like, are we in the, I always dismiss that evolutionary biology, you know, man spreads sperm, man wants young woman, as just utter bullshit.
Absolutely.
Because it just doesn't make sense to me on a lot of different levels. But the way it made it seem like, ooh, shit. Like, is it with us forever? This, like, men just feel like, you know, you get your reward at the end. And one of your rewards is the hot babe.
Well, and, you know, let's not ignore the fact that, you know, again, we're coming back around to this, oh, it's Hollywood. And so much of the movies is premised on, you know, the roles that especially young women get being ones where they're going to have to take their top off or do a nude scene, or they're going to, you know, where it's the women's, just like what the stuff that Hollywood is selling us, you know, which I tend not to think of movies this way, but God damn it, there is a lot of just like gratuitous sex in the movies still.
So can we talk about the way this is spread in the culture? Me Too, it's hashtag asking women to share their experiences of sexual assault. And then this shitty men media list, which has been circulating among journalists, which is the names of other men who women claim have harassed them. What did you guys think about the Me Too campaign?
Well, it is really all over my Facebook feed in particular, and which I think is the point of the campaign, right? Yeah, yeah. So its most recent iteration started when I believe the actress Alyssa Milano tweeted out, you know, if all the women who have been assaulted or harassed tweeted Me Too, we'd see the scale of the problem. But the campaign has actually been around for a lot longer. There's a woman named
Tarana Burke, who, as an activist in domestic violence and you know, in general about unity and solidarity, who started a Me Too campaign about 10 years ago.
Yeah. So that is, you know, coming off of that. And I think it has succeeded in explaining the scale of the problem. One thing that I feel a little hesitant about with it is that it does sort of conflate a range of behaviors, right? So a lot of people who are posting Me Too, I mean, the idea is that you should not have to go into the details of whatever this encounter is that you're discussing, but it can mean anything from like street harassment, I think, all the way up to rape. But you know, you don't really have a sense when someone posts what they're talking about. And I understand the argument that it's all part of a culture that creates this, you know, violence against women, but I also do think that there's a really meaningful difference between street harassment and rape. And the other thing that I want you guys to help me out with that I've been thinking about a lot this week, and I'm not arguing against it, I'm just struck by it, is that there does seem to be this collective embrace of victimhood or reclaiming of victimhood that women are doing around this. Like, in some ways, it's like a show of strength. Like, right, you've done this, but you know, screw you. I'm fine. On the other hand, there is something weird about every single, not weird. I don't quite know how to express this, but I'm a little uneasy with the idea that every woman, she doesn't have to, but many women are being like sort of asked to present themselves as victims or as part of this larger movement when they may not have processed whatever this experience was in that particular way. And I'm just struck by it as a cultural moment. I don't want to say it's good or bad. It just seems to be the universal collective desire in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, some of the best tweets in response to Weinstein, I mean, there's been this amazing, blossoming of great, great Twitter, even though there also was a Twitter boycott by women as part of the response, has been, come on, like, what is it? I think they're talking to men of saying, what exactly is it that you need before you believe women, before you believe that there's a problem, before that you accept that there's a problem and you pledge to do something or just even recognize this behavior that we're all surrounded by? And so that, I think, is very powerful, but also has this other side of like, do I have to present proof? Do I, and like this feeling of, do I have to perform my pain? Do I have to?
And do I even have to make it public if that's something that I don't want to make public?
And I think the scale of the response, the fact that so many people's social media feeds have been dominated by it is like, instead, it makes it, whereas typically, you're like, I choose what I post or don't post. I'm in control of my social media presence. But when something is so big, you're like, am I being a bad feminist if I don't take part in this?
Yeah.
Yeah, we already got emails about this one from a woman, Amanda Pyle, who was just so torn about it because she felt like there was a lot of pressure from her friends. And she says, I feel so much pressure to expose something deeply personal. If I don't post, how will I match my good feminist peers? Like, there's this kind of necessity. I have to post or I'm not a good feminist. There's a drive to kind of locate that part of yourself that was harassed. Now, interestingly, I usually feel this way. Like, I usually feel in these moments of performative, like kind of injustice where everyone kind of swirls together, it takes on an artificial aspect to me when it's in this, like it doesn't, when you're asked, especially because it's something so personal, when you're asked to kind of join a group and perform it, it always takes away for me from the intimacy and the realness. The thing is, in this one particular case, I didn't feel that way. And the reason I didn't feel that way is because of the way the Harvey Weinstein scandal, the way it unfolded, which is this just kind of shocking idea that for decades, people had just kind of this germ in them. They just kind of held on to it by themselves, and there's a way with women that everybody lives their little particular kind of shittiness. And they just kind of take that shittiness. And, you have like Angelina Jolie. I mean, there were so many people. Everybody had their version of it. And like with the Bill Cosby case, just kind of naming it, without the particulars, like the particulars didn't necessarily matter, but just kind of naming it, putting it out there, making it real. I feel that's really, really important in this particular
instance. Although there is an aspect, too, where the particulars are key because, as in Bill Cosby, as in so many of these cases, what happens is enough people come forward that it's clear that there's a pattern. And then somehow that when women see that there is a pattern, maybe that not only makes them think, if I come forward, I can prevent this pattern being used against another person. There's something powerful about recognizing the pattern.
Yes. And even though I just said that I don't think certain behaviors are equivalent, one other thing that I think caused this outpouring for so many women and is actually useful is in the Bill Cosby case, it was so much about the most extreme version of sexual violence against women, right? Like what people wanted to know are like, how many women did he rape or assault? In this case, so many of the things that came out with Weinstein are, behaviors that didn't quite cross that bar, but were obviously skeevy in the utmost
and made women feel really horrible.
Right. And made women feel horrible. And I think that's the key thing that people are responding to is like, okay, this thing has happened to me. I wouldn't go to the police with it. I wouldn't go to a supervisor with it. It doesn't seem to cross whatever bar, but it made me feel in this particular horrible way. And I think that's what people are posting me to about is the thing that, just made them feel a certain way. And I do agree that there is power in that. And I've been moved, if like tentative about being moved by it.
let's quickly talk about the Shitty Men media list. That is clearly like completely unfair, right? It's like a list of allegations against men, completely unfounded, that is now circulating among other journalists that would make it, you know, it harms these men's employment prospects. Like there's no proof. It's just, and it's everything from kind of rape to, you know, stole my ideas at a meeting, right? So it's that's what the list looks like. So to me, it's like obviously an unfair list. On the other hand, it's very against journalistic principles. What I would say about it is I wish women would circulate, like the sisterhood would say there's such a list, but there wouldn't actually be such a list. But we would make men think there was such a list, and then they would know that they can't get away with this shit. Like, nobody's going to keep it a secret anymore. We're always going to know, and we're always going to write it down, but not actually write it down. That, to me, is, like, the ideal way to do this.
Yeah. I have such complicated feelings about that list. On the one hand, like you just said, it just seems like the wrong... very bad for sort of like even democracy it seems like a little bit of a Stalinist situation. On the other hand, I did look at the list and I can't stop thinking about the list, and it confirmed many stories that I had heard sort of whispered.
Right. And that is in theory the purpose behind it, of like that, you know, as so many people said after the Weinstein allegations made it into the New York Times, like, oh, that also, you know, so there's these whisper campaigns that are around, but you have to be like in the chain of whispers to hear those. Mm-hmm. So it's an attempt to, you know, protect people by, you know, making, not having to be in a particular network to, you know, take advantage of the whispers. But
right.
Well, listeners, if you have any feelings about the Me Too campaign, whether you were moved or not moved, or not just the Me Too campaign, but how you feel at this moment. Do you feel pressured to share stories that you're not ready to share? Or do you think it's a good thing? Please let us know. You can go onto our Facebook page, XX GabFest, or you can write us if you want to do it more personally at XXGabFest@slate.com. And just for the record, Harvey Weinstein is denying unequivocally, all through his spokesman, all allegations of non-consensual sex. So let's just say that before we continue. All right, the juice. The HBO show created by David Simon and George Pelicanos about 42nd Street, prostitutes and the pimps that ruled it, and the birth of the porn trade. It stars James Franco as a set of twins who were, one of them anyway, the real-life inspiration for the show. Maggie Gyllenhaal as Candy, who's the prostitute who is pimpless. She's the empowered prostitute. Not really. Not exactly. But something like that. And then Dominic Fishback, who's just like awesome. Really. I mean, just in everything. She's one of the prostitutes who's got a spark of something going on. Some independence compared to the other ones. Anyway, I really like this show. I will say that right out. Let's talk about first the relationships between the prostitutes and the pimps. Which is one of the things I really like. There's a kind of mentorship going on that I think is brave to show and really interesting. What do you guys think about that?
Super complicated, obviously. I wouldn't characterize it as mentorship exactly. It's more like this fucked up, like, love power dynamic. I mean, speaking of sex and power being intertwined. But what the show shows is that it's not like these women hate their pimps who abuse them. They seek love from them. They seek affection from them, and they find it. And like even if it's not something that we would characterize as remotely healthy, they feel loved by them for the most part, it seems like.
Yeah. Even though, you know, sex worker wasn't the term used back then, but, you know, I think it's interesting to use it, even though it's not of the time, because one of the things that is very clear in their relationship is that it is work, and that they often talk about like not having the right attitude to work and needing motivation, which, you know, if we were seeing a simplified version of it, would be offensive. But in this context, is actually rings true in this relationship between pimps and sex workers. And also, we should say, I don't think we've mentioned that this show is set in 1971. And so there's this, you know, you can't help but look back and see, you know, the hair, the facial hair on the men, The pimps, with one exception, are black. They're prostitutes. The women under their care or under their command are often. They usually have both black and white. I don't know what the word to use. I guess prostitutes under their command. I guess. And so there are very interesting dynamics. It's complicated in a way that prestige television does very well these days. I don't know. I feel like we're not doing well at explaining, like, why is that? Because I came into the show kind of dreading, you know, like, oh, God, dudes making a show about sex work and pornography. I was kind of dreading it. But it's fascinating.
It doesn't like just go for the easy thing, which would be like, oh, these men are simply exploiting these women.
Yeah.
But it doesn't do the reverse. It sort of lets it sort of linger in all the uncomfortableness.
Yes.
I will say one, I do find in some ways the period details distracting, that in some instances I feel that they reach for cliche in terms of dialogue and characterization. And I mean, maybe pimps really were like this in the 1970s in Times Square, but it feels a little, those characters feel more cliched to me than anyone else in the show. The men and the women are actually more sort of finely drawn than the men, I would say. But I haven't watched the whole season yet. You know, the whole season hasn't aired, so who knows? But that is sort of my one issue with the show. It's like, sometimes you're like, really? Like,
David Simon has always had a thing for, like, the philosopher, you know, the philosopher who's, mm-hmm. you know, the sort of rough diamond kind of thing. And he certainly makes his pimps be philosopher kings.
Yes, but it feels, if it were like a set in 2017, I think I would have less resistance to that idea than I do here. It feels like nostalgic.
What I see in what you're talking about, the portrayal of the men versus the portrayal of the women, the kind of stock David Simon character, I feel himself holding himself back and extremely conscious of 2017 gender dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
I may be making that up. There is an interview with him and Terry Gross where he does talk about this. But on the one hand, he says he wants this show to feel like archival, like someone just, you know, found it in a box and it was actually filmed in 1971. So that explains just the excessive atmospherics and period details and all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, you know, you can feel, for example, with the pimps, what you said, June, he's kind of pulling, they're not philosopher diamonds in the rough the way they are in The Wire. Like, he seems to not want you to love them quite that much, so that he's like, you know, he puts down the gate so that he's not fully embracing them the way he would a kind of violent character, because they are violent against women. So in the pilot episode was almost too much for me. Like, it was the violence against, between the there was a particular incident between a pimp and one of his women, which made you not, he had been totally charming up until, charming in that kind of sick way, but still charming. And then David Simon kind of, or George Pelicanos, whoever did this, pulled it back pretty hard and pretty abruptly, because he did something pretty awful. And whereas with the women, like you said, Noreen, they're so conscious of drawing them richly, of making completely varied types, you know, the kind of totally ruined ones, the semi-empowered but then ruined ones. It's like really a kind of rich panoply of women in the sex trade, which is interesting. And also the way they film the sex. I mean, let's talk about that a little bit. It's like they're trying so hard to show you the truth without being titillating.
Yeah.
Do you guys think they were successful at that? Because it is a show about the sex trade. So like you said, Noreen, you're just like, ugh, a bunch of guys making a show about this. It's just going to be about sex, you know? But it isn't exactly.
No, I mean, it's not sexy.
No.
There are relationships between characters who aren't pimps and prostitutes. And those are a little sexier. But the way that there are porn scenes later on that are filmed that are just, you know,
all about the business.
Yeah. And the sex scenes with the Johns are, I forget who observed this, maybe Emily Nussbaum in her review, but there is such a focus on actually the in many cases, grotesqueness of the men's bodies and the way they sort of loom over these women. And you start to think about what's happening in that room. And then there are later incidents where it becomes clear, you know, just how violent and scary it can get. But yeah, there's nothing particularly sexy about this show. Yeah. And yet it's fun to watch really weird way.
Yeah, it's a show that has really made me kind of question why I watch shows, because I'm not into the concept of it at all. And, you know, sometimes I'll watch a show for a romance. There is one romance in the show, I would think we could say, between a journalist type character and a cop that, you know, I'm kind of rooting for that, but that's not exactly, certainly not the reason I'm watching it.
But what about the James Franco? There's also the James Franco college girl gone bad romance, which I'm kind of interested in.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. And I'm pleasantly surprised by how much James Franco kind of fades into the background, because he can be a focus puller and he's not doing that this time. Sometimes I'll watch a show because it's offering a look that I, you know, it's showing me something that I don't know, or sometimes I'll watch a show because I want representation either of myself or other groups that I don't think I've seen enough of. And I don't quite know what it is in this. Maybe it is kind of that I feel like it's sort of showing me history, not so much about New York in 1971, which feels a little bit, it feels a bit overexposed somehow, but just about the origins of this incredibly influential, incredibly important, you know, big chunk of our economy and something that's very influential. And it's interesting.
But in a way, in this David Simon way where it's like, okay, it's about the porn trade. But what you have to understand about the porn trade is that it is because the mafia wanted to, like, you know, be able to get a cut of the prostitution.
And so, crooked cops wanted a cut.
Wanted a cut. And here's how it, and here's why the obscenity laws weren't enforced. And you can see it sort of like setting up to go all through that sort of David Simon-y, it's all connected and it's all money's fault kind of thing, which I enjoy. But it is, I will also say, it's kind of like The Wire with wigs a little bit.
Yeah.
Like it's this, there's a no-go zone in Times Square where the cops are not going to go after anyone. And that's like Amsterdam from The Wire. And there are unions involved and many of the same characters are involved. And I loved The Wire, so I'm not totally upset, but there is a little bit of familiarity to it.
So David Simon, in his interview with Terry Gross, they had this really interesting exchange where Terry Gross was kind of schoolmarmish and talked about how she was walking down the street to go to a party now in 2017. And she very like gingerly said, and, you know, the women going to the party were kind of dressed like the prostitutes on your show. And it was a little, you know, shocking that she said that. But then he launched into this thing about the ubiquitous influence of porn and how porn has taken over everything, basically, and completely shifted our norms. And I know this. I've read books about this. Yeah. But for some reason, it was alarming to me. And I started to see the show in this totally different light. Like, oh, it's a show that's about the beginning of everything.
Yeah.
Did you guys buy that whole line?
Absolutely. About, yeah. I think, you know, I haven't looked at porn for decades, and yet I feel like so much of I only mention that to say, like, my life is about as far from porn as you can get. And yet I feel like the way we see ourselves, the way we look at other people, the way that we groom ourselves, even if we've never actually had firsthand encounters with porn, is shaped by porn. And that is crazy.
Totally. And especially coming after our Hugh Hefner discussion, it just felt all of a piece.
And I have to say, sorry, I keep interrupting you, you know, one of the things that is interesting in the show is that these are pre-peak porn bodies. Mm-hmm. Like the prostitutes, the sex workers show their bodies, they use their bodies, but they have real bodies, not the kind of bodies that people have
plasticky.
Now.
Yeah, it's funny. Maggie Gyllenhaal like purposely never wears a bra. She doesn't have a plasticky body at all in this show. Aside, since you brought this up about the bodies, this is something my friend Margaret brought up, that the one period detail they can't get right is like the men's bodies, because she was pointing out in the 70s men were slimmer, but they weren't cut. You know, there's just a kind of body that doesn't really exist anymore. That's kind of not toned the way James Franco's body is toned. And like those that period, like even the college girl gone bad, she has a 2017 look. Like a 2017 body, the kind of arms, everything like that. It's all just kind of nicely toned.
Yeah,
that's interesting. And one I just really loved that interview they did with Terry Gross. Actually, like it sort of. It put the show into context for me as actually a feminist piece of art, although I don't think that they said that. Like they were sort of I appreciated just the way that they were thinking about things without being too self-congratulatory. Like they do have a writer's room that has women in it. They, you know, women directed half of the episodes. This woman who's well known for her work on Breaking Bad was super involved in it. They seem to have like done all of the right things. And yet they also had their sort of late middle-aged man way of seeing the world that they were bringing to this interview. And I just kind of love the tension between those two things. And it's worth listening to.
Yeah. And I mean, in a sense, I do get the feeling that they're kind of atoning with this show, you know, in a way that we all are now. We're all making up for our bad attitudes, especially men, you know, but especially people in this industry. The Wire is not The Sopranos. It's definitely not Game of Thrones. But you know, I think everybody who's made a prestige TV show, you know, especially like one on HBO where you can show bodies, has something to make up for. And I don't think that's why they made this show. But so like they're kind of atoning, and I'm glad, and it is interesting.
All right, we got to wrap this up. But one other thing, the bar that kind of launches this show, which is the bar that the James Franco character rules over, is an homage. It's like the one space where, you know, transgender, queer, gay, white, black, like it was the one place that wasn't segregated. Not the one place, what do I know? But it was a place unique in this way in which everyone was welcome. That's one of the bits of research that they did, and it makes the bar a particularly interesting locale.
And I have to say, just to extend slightly, that I also love the diner, which is another place, you know, where different people get to meet, where cops and prostitutes and pimps and, you know, just folks, mailmen having their breakfast, hang out. And it's a place both of judgment and non-judgment. And it's really interesting. And as somebody who grew up on British soap operas that often have like a pub as the main central location, I'm really appreciative of those places.
All right. All hail the pub. Okay. So let's talk about ageism and our complicity in it. Woof. Okay, Ashton Applewhite, who's a writer in New York, wrote a story in the New York Times that kind of messed with my head. I'm just going to be completely out there here. This topic is for me, and you guys are going to help me with this. That's just how it's going to be. She wrote, trying to pass for younger is like a gay person trying to pass for straight or a person of color for white. These behaviors are rooted in shame over something that shouldn't be shameful, and they give a pass to the underlying discrimination that makes them necessary. I.e. Harvey Weinstein. I recently reviewed the Kurt Anderson book Fantasyland, where I learned that in his youth, like I think maybe 70s. Anyway, in his youth, no women, none of the moms colored their hair. That's like a new thing, you know, that coloring your gray hair is a new thing. And then this article calls it a kind of display of shame. So I have a lot of thoughts about this, but since I've already soapboxed enough already for the start of this, did you guys buy this manifesto about gray hair, shame, older, younger?
I did, and then I spiraled and started looking at face creams. Like, I'm not even kidding. So on the one hand, yes, I think that we should all reclaim our aging faces. On the other hand, I just don't want mine to age.
On the other hand, face cream.
And on the other hand, like, it's a real thing. Like, you know, ageism in the workplace, and especially if you're trying to get hired, is so for real. And so I completely understand, you know, it's like, you know, it's wrong. It's like, do you really feel shame when you know that the system is absolutely screwed up and in a sense you're a victim of it?
Well, there are like two separate questions, almost separate but related. It's like people feel shame over aging because of, you know, women in particular worry about, you know, their sexual, like the way that they are perceived as sexually viable beings, as attractive, as, you know, all these things that we've spent our entire lives sort of conforming to these standards, and all of a sudden you're not. And so that's one set of sort of one sense of loss mm-hmm. over that. And then there's this idea that in the workplace you will be less desirable too, that you
nobody wants to hire their mom.
No one wants to hire their mom. And I think that those are like a little bit different. And the second one seems like we should be able to fix it, right? Like, wisdom is such an important part of any office, and it's just, that seems like there will be at some point a reckoning with the danger of having just 25-year-olds run everything. So that one I'm more hopeful about. This like deeper question of looking in the mirror and feeling, you know, less than you used to be. Maybe that one just terrifies me more. I don't know.
I don't want to talk too much because I really want to hear from Hannah, who said she was on her soapbox but only spoke for about 30 seconds. So I want to hear that soapbox. But like, I've always been almost completely oblivious to my appearance, like more than I really should. But I must admit that like, I take great pride in not coloring my hair. But I'm not sure if I would if it hadn't not turned.
You don't have gray hair.
I don't have gray hair. So like, it's easy. Like, it's my only point of appearance pride. So like, I, this whole thing of like depriving yourself of food to stay skinny, not doing that. But like, I wonder if I would color my hair if it was, or like my hairdresser recently, like just for a lark, suggested putting like blue or purple or something. Mm. And I was like, oh no, because I don't want to make it seem like I color my hair. Mm. So like, I was actually then working into that whole still. So if it even affects me, who really should take more care of her appearance, then like, it clearly is very, very, very.
June looks great, by the way.
BT dubs look fantastic, but yeah. But come on, so tell me what
June,
you
have a look. What
yes,
do I
do.
Think?
I
okay.
Have a look.
You do have a look. Part of my pushback against this article, like at first I was like, no. And here's my pushback against it. You know, in the John Cheever era, like women over, like they just weren't in the game after like 32. You know, you would have casual references in novels of that era and even more modern novels that like she was past her prime, you know, or like no one looked at her anymore. Or there was just this sense that like it was a given in the culture that you were done, like you were done sexually and you were done professionally in a way. And my pushback to that is that maybe the fact that women are coloring their hair is a kind of fuck you and a sign that we're still in the game, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like there's nobody's giving up and nobody expects you to give up. And, you know, we're still playing. That's one way to look at it. It's a sign of actually increasing sort of power and visibility, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to the kind of middle-aged women are invisible line that so many people like to say, like maybe it's the opposite, you mm-hmm. know, they're still visible. Now, about the details, I mean, it's just exhausting. Like, I often think,
yes,
you know, my hair is probably gray if I don't color it. And my mom's hair was white at a very young age. Like, the women in my family go gray super young. And it was true of my mom, and she did not color her hair. Mm. She happens to look fabulous with white hair, but she never colored her hair. And I just think, like, then I think, like, this meant, like, how little time and money they have to spend.
Yep.
They just walk in the world. Now they do go to the gym and stuff. Like there is a, and maybe you can Brooklyn me here and be like, are you kidding? Like with the beards and the this and the beard oil, like maybe that's changed a lot, you know? But in general, there are just like bottom line maintenance things that you have to do to walk around in your workplace and, you know, feel like in the game that are like exhausting, you know?
Yeah.
And that come at a time when you have children. It's just like a lot of time and effort.
Yeah.
And so every once in a while, I think like, fuck it, I'm not going to color my hair. And then my hairdresser is like, no, not yet. In 20 years, Hannah. So anyway,
yeah,
I don't, that's, I just am of two minds. Here's what I really want. I want one of our listeners to give me a manifesto on gracefully entering this phase of life. Like, maybe you read it somewhere, like maybe you, it could be like an actress wrote it in her memoirs, or it could be like totally self-helpy. I need guidance. That's all about how not to be like rageful and going back and forth and just like had to move through this phase gracefully.
No. See, I you don't want that, Hannah. I don't think like suddenly you're looking for graceful now. No, come on. No, that is not like the desired move. You know,
and
as
that
you,
was mean.
As you know, as you said earlier, now you it's like it's all about saying, no, I'm not changing. I'm still here. Like, I'm not going to like conform to some view of some graceful middle-aged lady. I'm still vital. I'm like, I've got ideas up the wazoo. Like, what has changed? No, why should I conform to some script? I'm all for that. Never mind.
So can
graceful.
I go gray?
Totally.
I don't think you should go gray. Spoken like a woman who spent a lot of time on face cream websites. I don't know. I think like part of my fear about getting older is not recognizing myself. Mm-hmm. And if what helps you feel like yourself is having the same color hair or even like, you know, a platinum blonde or whatever you've decided to have, then I think you should do it. Like, I think if I looked in the mirror and my hair were gray, that would upset me more than any kind of cultural shame. And so I plan to dye my hair until the day I die, although I haven't started yet. And I'm going to go like really crazy colors when I do. I can't wait.
Maybe if I could get over like the men don't do it problem, and maybe I could just convince myself I'm wrong. Men do it. They go to the gym. Like, men do have a lot of kind of upkeep that they have to do if they don't want to just let it go. You know, so it's not fair to say only women do it, because men do stuff, you know?
They have to watch their backs. Yeah.
Don't you think this is – okay, so my big thing is that I think it's not just about shame. I think it's mostly about fear of death,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so men like react to fear of death in other ways, like, you know, the classic – middle-aged
what's that even called?
A midlife crisis, yeah. Right, so they have a midlife crisis, and we, you know,
look at face creams,
dye our hair, etc. Maybe that's too pat, but I really do think it's not about shame. It's about death coming for us all, the inevitability.
It's true.
And one of the things we read you know, had a, it was just a truism, but like, confidence is an aphrodisiac, that you just have to, you know, that it's not about not being sexy or not having an interest in sex or not having sex appeal. If you're confident and if you seem like you're a person, you know, who's ready up for it, or I don't even know what the term is, but like, ugh, that sounded so not cool. But anyway.
I know what you mean. You do get that. That is right. One gift of getting older is you do have that. You like sink into that without much reservation. So, you know, God gives us something. All right. Well, enough of that. All right. Let's move on to our recommendations. But June, you have some things to tell us first.
Yes, I just want to mention a few things. All the people listening to this know all about podcasts and spend time listening to podcasts. You've found lots of shows you love, like this one, hopefully. But what about podcasts for your kids? Until now, the offerings have been spotty and hard to find. That's why Panoply created Pinna, an entire audio service just for kids. Pinna is a standalone iPhone app, just iPhones for the moment, filled with hours of original stories and serials, great podcasts, and all-you-can-listen audiobooks. And there's more added each week. Audio gets your kids off screens and lets them use their imaginations. Pinna is ad-free, guilt-free, and a great activity for car time, bath time, group time, bedtime, or any time. Try Pinna for free by going to Pinna, that's PINNA.FM/listen, to start your free trial today. That's pinna.fm/listen to start your free trial. I also want to mention that if you are in New York on the anniversary of the 2016 election results, there is a fantastic Slate event. It will take stock of the year that was and celebrate the work of those who have served as a check on this administration. You can join Slate writers for a series of one-on-one conversations with those at the forefront of politics, media, the law, and activism as they compare notes on the lessons, challenges, and victories they've seen over the past year and what they expect from the next. There'll be Jamel Bowie in conversation with Tom Perriello, who's a former Democratic gubernatorial candidate from Virginia. Isaac Chotner will talk with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer for The New Yorker and a professor at Columbia Journalism School. Dahlia Lithwick will be in conversation with Becca Heller, founder of the International Refugee Assistance Project. Michelle Goldberg in conversation with Tamika Mallory from the Women's March. And Jordan Weissman will be in conversation with Rashad Robinson, executive director of Color of Change. And it will be all hosted by Julia Turner. That's on November 8th at the New School Auditorium in New York. For information and tickets, visit slate.com/live. And as always, if you're a Slate Plus member, you get 30% off your purchase.
All right. Recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
I have been reading a cookbook, sort of a cookbook, called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat by Samin Nosrat with illustrations by Wendy McNaughton. And it's Samin Nosrat worked in the kitchen of Chez Panisse, and then she cooked in other kitchens. And it's basically, like, it explains the chemistry behind cooking. It breaks it down into these elements. And I've always sort of, I love to cook. I cook a lot and from recipes, but I've always resisted the sort of scientific aspect of it. Like, that's not my preferred kind of, you know, way of thinking about cooking. But this sort of combines it, like, I think even she uses this example. It gives you the chords that you can have in order to play Chaz. And it breaks down things that you understand instinctively about taste and kind of breaks down the science of it without feeling too sciencey. And there are sort of recipes, but not really. It's more like you understand, like, okay, here are different ways I can use vinegar to cut this mistake that I made. Or, like, here are flavors that will combine in a pleasing way. And this is exactly why it happens. And this is what the salt does when you put it on at this point. And this is what the salt does when you put it on at that point. And this is why, like, this brand of kosher salt works better than that brand of kosher salt. Like, and it has to do with the size of the crystals. And I'm super into it.
Wow.
Wow, you're like a really intellectual cook.
I think you get to do that when you're not cooking for a family. Like, I'm not, like, trying to put on, you know, dinner for six every night.
I'd love to cook, but it never occurred to me to, like, to ask the question why when I'm cooking.
But it's really helpful. Like, it's not even like why, it's like practical guidance. I actually don't like the sort of fussy, you know,
sciencey
cooking. Yeah, I don't like that kind. This is I promise, this is like the chemistry in everyday life kind of version of the science.
All right, I trust you. I love new cookbooks. Okay, so Wyclef Jean's new album, the third in the Carnival series, is just so hitting the spot for me these days. I've been holed up and making a radio story for the last few weeks, and that's my only break. It's so beautiful. It's so moving. It's, like, really romantic. It has a lot of homages to his favorite artists. It's called The Fall and Rise of a Refugee, and I don't know, just love it. Very soothing. So check it out.
Cool.
So, June, what do you have?
So the final season of Halt and Catch Fire ended last weekend, and I just loved it so much. And I think that the audience wasn't that big, and I, as many critics have observed, this is probably a show that will catch on long after it finished airing because it's such good quality, but I think people were kind of intimidated about watching it every week, and it'll be something that will be super successful as a streaming show. But the final season was so pleasing because it really, you know, yes, it had plot in a sense. It was about the race between, like, web directories and search engines as a way of navigating the web. But it was much more than that. It was really something that you rarely see on television, which it just kind of covered big issues like, what's it like to have a really long-term relationship with people? Not just love relationships, but friend relationships, or former husband, what's it like to be really close to someone, then to kind of be out of their lives in a certain way, but still in their lives because you have kids together? What's it like to have ambition? What's it like to work with someone really closely and then not work with them for a while? Just things that, you know, could be banal, but the way that they handled these big topics was so satisfying and so kind of thought-provoking that I just love the show. So if you didn't watch Halt and Catch Fire, it's something that it's worth watching from the beginning. There's only four seasons, but the last season in particular was really great. And I think it is stronger if you've kind of put in the time with the other seasons, but just a beautiful show, Halt and Catch Fire.
I'm going to watch it.
There are members of my family who love that show. Mm. I have never watched it. Sounds great. All right, well, that's our show for today. Thank you to our producer, Verilyn Williams, our wonderful intern, Daniel Schrader. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.